It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, asparagus is one of the first spring veggies we're getting excited about. We'll get some asparagus advice from farm-to-table chef Ian Knauer.
But first, the University of Wisconsin system will likely end the current fiscal year with over $1 billion in surplus. Governor Walker today proposed a two-year tuition freeze to make education more affordable, he said.
That comes on the heels of a similar two-year tuition freeze, which is part of the budget bill Governor Walker signed into law last year.
We've asked Noel Radomski, director of the Wisconsin Center for the Advancement of Post-Secondary Education, to give some insight on the budget surplus and how an additional two-year tuition freeze could affect the UW system and its students. Noel, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon.
So why did Governor Walker call for a second two-year tuition freeze for the UW system today?
Well, similar to just prior to the last year or the last biennial budget, UW system came out this morning at their Board of Regents meeting stating that they had a slightly over $1 billion in reserves. And there was confusion on what that actually means. For example, is it are any of those is the $1 billion plus restricted or unrestricted, meaning do they have a plan to spend the money or do they not have a plan to spend the money? And there's lots of confusion. There was confusion 3 years ago, and again, there's confusion this morning. So what that then triggered was Governor Walker then to say, we're going to propose a tuition freeze, a tuition cap, during the next biennial budget. And then we had the Assembly Majority Leader Robin Voss came out with a press release stating the same thing. So now it's percolating throughout the legislature and the governor's office saying, here we go again, second time. We're tired of tuition increases. We're tired of the UW system not being fully transparent with this. And therefore, we are where we are today.
So as you said, there's already one of these two-year tuition freezes in place. Mm-hmm. If this passes, that'll be a total of 4 years. How significant is that?
It's very significant, both short-term and long-term. The short-term is we are using our reserves for something that in the past, recent past, was picked up partially by the state. So what that means then is for to offer salary increases for our faculty or to retain certain faculty or recruit faculty, there'll be limited revenues to do that. There's uncertainty in whether or not the governor and the legislature will increase state taxes to the UW system, or will they do what they did last time, is they will reduce the state contribution and substitute that with the reserves. So from a short-term perspective, it could have some immediate impact on both the hiring and the retention of our faculty. Long-term, there's a couple things going on. One, this is percolating throughout the country. And as other public and private universities begin to focus on new areas of focus for their universities, they raid faculty, especially at those universities that they see are vulnerable. So if there are, you know, such as the UW system, so UW-Milwaukee, UW-Madison, UW-Stevens Point, the salaries for faculty and staff have been relatively low increases. So you'll see, I would predict we'll see more faculty, unfortunately, that will be raided from our campuses, which will have a direct impact on our teaching and also in our research grants that we get. If we lose some of our star faculty, they take their federal research dollars with them.
That's been a critique that's been made before of the UW system that it has had, even before the budget freeze, or the tuition freeze, rather, has had the effect of not retaining faculty at the UW system, maybe not having difficulty in doing that. But besides the faculty issue, what about upkeep and existing programs and facilities, things like that?
Yeah. Well, as it relates to facilities, that will be a separate revenue sources through the State Building Commission. So that won't be impacted through this decision. But other operating support, such as academic advising, which is critical, especially at larger universities like Milwaukee and Madison, that will be impacted. Libraries, expenses such as information technology, those all could be affected by this decision if it's approved by the legislature in the next biennial budget.
Now, Governor Walker said he was calling for this two-year tuition freeze to help students and families to get access to higher education, in particular working families. Just how helpful will this tuition freeze be for those students that he's targeting?
I think that's true in the sense of if the tuition is frozen, obviously, the cost of the parent and the students won't increase, such as what's going on in the state of Minnesota or other states nearby. So from that perspective, he's absolutely correct. The unknown question is, as stated, as we just discussed, what impact will that have on the quality of the instruction? So, yes, it will help the students and the families, but at what cost? And if it were just for a two-year period, most universities can handle it, but we're now talking about 4 years of this, so it raises some important questions. Again, I'm not downplaying the issues that came through having yet again reserves in the area of $1 billion that aren't fully explained to legislators and to the governor. So I don't want to downplay that.
Now, having a big rainy day fund, a surplus, is considered a prudent thing oftentimes for large institutions. Why has the UW system surplus been so contentious?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Just like a family or a business, you always want to have some money on the side if your car breaks down or if you need to put a new roof in, or if you're a business, you want to expand your product line, so you need to buy some new equipment. And colleges, universities are the same way. The whole question is, how big is it? And how do you explain what is truly reserves that are projected, as opposed to those that are not projected? And I think that's where that's the big issue. And I think that there's some really interesting questions related to how the UW system basically. States their revenue sources, whether or not they're investing. If you have a large surplus and if you're not going to be spending it for 1 or 2 or 3 years, that's a significant amount of money that could be invested, and therefore that rate of return could be used to hire more faculty. So there's a lot of unintended consequences if you have too large of a reserve, so that the university is not investing that the unused money, the surplus.
A lot of talk these days about the heavy load that students are carrying in debt after they graduate from college, how it could be stopping them from saving for retirement, for instance, maybe getting married, putting a mortgage down, getting a mortgage on a house. Is this the sort of thing that you see families in Wisconsin cheering because it's some relief?
Yeah, absolutely. And you saw it at the biennial budget. You had Democrats and Republicans from both the Senate and the Assembly basically saying, this is a good thing, having a tuition freeze. So you're right. It's, and I obviously Governor Walker and some others are going through re-election in November. So it certainly sells well with the public. So you're absolutely right. With the large tuition increases over the last decade, partly due to reductions in state funding, students had to take out larger loans, and therefore, when they graduate, instead of buying a car, they may buy a used car, or instead of buying a house, they may wait 2 or 3 or 4 years to buy a house. So yes, you're right. This is whether or not it would actually decrease the level of student debt is uncertain, but you're right. It won't increase, and therefore it may help families and students.
Transparency was an issue the last time a billion-dollar surplus was announced, and that was something that legislators took issue with. And we've got another big surplus again. How is the transparency issue looking today?
Just as bad as 2 or 3 years ago. Yesterday they provided some information on how their endowment is doing, the UW system endowment, which is another topic. Basically, UW system, unlike other states, other systems in other states, they don't combine their financial reports. So we can all see, you know, here's an endowment from UW system, right? They have quite a bit of money in there, and then they invest that, just like we have GPR and tuition in reserves. So I guess the issue here in the UW system is, are we behind the times in having a more robust and more comprehensive and more transparent financial system? And then it has a direct impact on campuses. You know, some folks have said perhaps there should be greater authority and greater accountability at the individual campus level. So why is it that the reserves are staying at UW system, whereas the chancellors of every campus like Milwaukee and Whitewater, La Crosse, they know how much reserves they are collecting? So why doesn't that money stay there? And then they have, they're close, they know which faculty need to be retained and which faculty need to be hired and which programs need to be created to better serve the businesses in their regions. So I think there's a really fundamental question that we didn't ask and we didn't answer in the last time around. And I think that we'll see some, if people are going to be candid about this, they'll ask the question, what is the role of the UW system? What is the role of the UW institutions? And should there be a transfer of power more to the individual campuses so that they're held accountable?
No, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
We've been talking to Noel Radomski, director of the Wisconsin Center for the Advancement of Postsecondary Education.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Well, it's time to get digging in the dirt again, to head back to the farmers markets and just enjoy the color green. Well, our next guest is with us to celebrate the return of one of spring's first vegetables, asparagus.
On Food Friday, Ian Knauer joins us once a month. He's back today. He's the host of a PBS series called The Farm and author of the cookbook by the same name. Ian grows his own food on his family land in Pennsylvania. Ian, welcome back.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
Well, as we mentioned, Ian, one of the first veggies that I get excited about anyway is the asparagus. Do you grow that on your farm, and is it popping up yet?
We do, and it's just starting to pop its tips out of the soil. Actually, asparagus is one of those vegetables that will come back year after year after year. So some of the asparagus that is growing on my family's farm was planted there by my grandfather some 30 years ago, and it's still barely holding on and gives us some asparagus from him every year.
Oh, do you still eat it? Does it still taste as good as the newer stuff you plant?
It tastes just like asparagus.
And that's a good thing. Well, how exciting is it as a farmer to see the spring growing season begin again?
Oh, especially after this winter.
I mean,
I feel like it was such a doozy everywhere in this country. We were just waiting and waiting and waiting for anything green to pop up. And the last couple days, at least here on the East Coast, I can't speak for you guys, have been just exquisitely beautiful. It's such a welcome change.
Oh, here too. Well, with the asparagus, I'll eat it year-round. I'll eat the stuff trucked in from the southern hemisphere because I really like my asparagus. But it does get better. How can we judge asparagus? What makes it the perfect ripeness, if we describe ripeness for asparagus?
The real key to finding the freshest asparagus is how snappy it is, how easily and crisp it is when you break it in half, or when you take a bite out of it, too. You can really taste the difference texturally between stuff that is grown in season and stuff that is grown somewhere else in the world and then shipped in. So that's the best way to do it. Take a bite out of it, and it's super crispy and crunchy and watery, then you'll know that it's local and it's fresh.
Sometimes I have a very slight issue with asparagus in that I hate it when I get the part of the stalk that just is like chewing cardboard. And I never know, like when I'm cooking it, because my family loves asparagus, how to make sure you don't end up serving people that part. And generally, I chop it so close to the tip that that's all I'm serving. I have a feeling I'm wasting a lot. Is there a rule for how to be, you know, sure that you're getting the good stuff?
Yeah, there are a couple tricks. One is that asparagus are like snowflakes. Each one is a little different. So if you cut them all the same length, some will be trimmed the proper length, and others will be still a little too long, and you'll have some of that woody bottom on the end of the stalk. So instead of just cutting them all off and lopping them off with a knife, you want to take it in your fingertips, each hand on each side of the stalk of asparagus, and then add some pressure, 0.5 pointing it away from you so that it snaps, and it'll know where to snap. The asparagus will know where it needs to snap so that you're left with only the tender parts instead of the woody parts.
Okay, so now, trust the wisdom of the asparagus.
Exactly, yeah. The asparagus is smarter than you are. So
Wait, what?
The other trick is to do what the French do. They peel the bottom of the stalk with a vegetable peeler. Now, that's sort of a pain, but I do have to say that if you want a perfectly evenly crisp or tender stalk of asparagus, it is the way to go. It's also quite pretty when you peel the bottoms.
So we've found our perfectly fresh asparagus. We've snapped it or peeled it appropriately. What do you like to do to prepare it, Ian?
Well, asparagus is one of those vegetables where I think most of us just have it steamed all the time because it's easy, and it's also great that way. But I actually love it any way that I can imagine. So I love to puree it. I love to slice it sort of paper thin and eat it raw. That makes a really great salad. You can also use a vegetable peeler to make long shavings with it, long ribbons with it, raw ribbons. Or I like it pureed into soups. I love it roasted. So pretty much any way that I can think of to eat it is how I'm going to eat it.
Can you give us a simple recipe? If you're going to do an asparagus soup, how would you approach that?
Mm-hmm. So I would start out by cooking some aromatics, maybe some clove of garlic or some leeks would be great, or a shallot, in just a little bit of butter or olive oil if you prefer that. Not until it's brown, but until it's translucent. Then you want to add some sort of light chicken stock, or you could even use vegetable stock or water if you want to, and add your asparagus to that stock and boil it until it's very tender. Now, for a soup, you can go beyond cooking like you would if you were just going to steam it, for instance, where you might want it crisp tender. So you want to go until it's still bright green but is pretty mushy, and then you just blend it all up. You can finish it with a little cream or a little crème fraîche if you want a richer soup, or you can just keep it simple and let that asparagus shine through.
Mm. Are there any spices that go particularly well? I usually just do kosher salt and pepper when I do it in my cast iron skillet. Anything else that goes really well with asparagus in the herbs and spices family?
I do really like nutmeg with it. That's sort of a classic pairing, and not too much. You don't want to go too heavy on the nutmeg, but just a pinch at the end, like if you're making that soup, for instance, gives it sort of a sophisticated air to it.
What about cinnamon?
No.
Cinnamon is, you know, I've never tried cinnamon with asparagus, but it might not be a bad idea if you pair it with some other warm spices like cumin and coriander. Throw all those in there, just a little bit, a pinch of each, and you might end up with something that's sort of Moroccan-inspired.
Oh, that sounds pretty good. I'm just trying to make Rob feel bad. He's allergic to
cinnamon. Yeah. She just doesn't want to share. Can you
Let's
believe
just
it?
Put it in everything.
I do like it, yeah. So what else are you, cooking with besides asparagus? Is there anything that's up enough that you can actually be eating it yet?
Yes. Around here, we are eating ramps. Starting today. Today is the first day that I've found some ramps that are big enough to pick and eat. And that's always a treat in the spring. I love ramps. They're sort of like funky wild leeks. They've got a lot more flavor than garlic or leeks, and they're sort of a combination of the two. So I love them. All the chefs I know around here love them, and we all eagerly await the first time that we cook ramps.
You can't cultivate ramps, right? Is it something you have to forage for?
So this is a great myth. I'm so glad that you brought that up, because this is what foragers say, that no, you can't cultivate ramps, and therefore the prices at the market are incredibly high. In the green market in New York, there's something like $20 a pound, which is shocking for garlic. But you can actually cultivate them if you have the right environment. So when you buy ramps, there's a little nub on the bottom where the roots are. That's a nodule that actually acts as a rhizome. So if you cut that off and plant that, it has a pretty good chance of sprouting some more ramps a couple years down the road.
Hmm.
Now, the atmosphere that you want is near a creek or some gently running water, but not in it. So watercress likes to be in the running water. Ramps like to be just on the edge. They like a good dose of water every month or so if we get a heavy rain, but they don't like to live in it all the time.
So we can break the monopoly of Big Ramp and grow our own.
That's right. Stick it to the man.
Well, Ian, thanks so much for coming on. It was always fun to talk with you.
Oh, I had a great time. Happy spring.
Happy spring to you, too. Well, that was Ian Knauer, host of the PBS series The Farm and the author of the cookbook by the same name. I'm pretty sure he told me that asparagus is smarter than I am.
Yeah, I got that impression. I kind of believe it. I'm going to try that snapping thing because I usually just go with the knife and lop it all at the same spot. And then you're right, Veronica, you get that chewy bit
right
at the end of like a third of them
the
or
dregs.
So yeah, and the kids like spit it out, and yeah, so yeah, a great tip. Thanks to Ian Knauer for that. Hey, coming up Monday here on Central Time, new guidelines say we are still not eating enough fruits and vegetables, a reason to get that asparagus going. We'll find out why it may be time to up our servings.
And a new Conservation Congress vote is coming up. We'll tell you what's on the table, including a proposal to hunt swans.
And CBS News travel writer Peter Greenberg shares his love of roaming and exploring. It'll be a lot of fun. He's a good interview. He has a lot of fun on the radio. He'll have some advice for our summer travel as well.
That's all coming up tomorrow on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll talk to a guest who says student loan debt is affecting people's prospects for upward mobility in the United States.
First, we'll focus on another issue that affects young people. Manufacturers in Wisconsin are struggling to attract young people to their industries. As Brianne Shasau reports, they'll be needed to fill vacancies left by people retiring.
18-year-old Jamumia Starks is the kind of worker any company would love to see walk through the door. He's young, enthusiastic, and has real-world experience. Here he is showing off a high-tech machine that's cutting metal.
When it slows down, it's going to spin this way, and then it's going to turn that way, and then that's when I got to put the screw in.
Starks is a part-time employee at Production Machine and Enterprises Corporation in Madison. He was drawn to manufacturing because of his passion for skateboarding.
The bottom of the skateboard, there's trucks, and there's metal, and I was wondering how they made that. So, the whole time, I was growing up, I was skateboarding and wondering how they made it.
Starks is the company's first student from middle college. It's a program that combines high school academics, technical college courses, and work experience that prepares low-income students for careers in manufacturing and healthcare. Chuck Pitzlin manages operations for Production Machine and Enterprises Corporation. He says the middle college program is a great way to bring young people, like Starks, into manufacturing.
There's a shortage of qualified people and even people coming out of the tech school program. So we do try to work with the tech school. We've actually worked with high schools and done tours and things like that to try to generate an interest in manufacturing just to raise an awareness.
This raising of awareness has taken on added importance and urgency for the manufacturing sector because a lot of its workers are reaching retirement age. Data from the current population survey shows the number of workers in the industry under 35 fell about 19% between 2003 and 2013. Meanwhile, the number of workers over 55 increased more than 39%. Joe Brown heads talent development at the Wisconsin Manufacturing Extension Partnership. He says companies have to change the way young people look at their industry. He says there's a myth that manufacturing is behind the times, dirty, and has headed offshore.
They don't see manufacturing in the true light that it really is it's a dynamic environment.
Brown says companies are realizing they have to get to young people sooner before they enter the workforce.
They're accessing the kids at a much younger age than what they ever have. The old model for manufacturers was fill the resume pipeline as full as possible and then just select from there. That's not the reality anymore. The reality is that you have to compete for these kids.
One of those kids is high school senior Nick Preston. He's working for a manufacturer in Kiel as part of the state's youth apprenticeship program. Preston says everybody, from CEOs to plant managers, needs to be a part of the recruiting effort.
I think if you can get it into the schools, make the kids know about it. Make the principal, the teachers, the counselors, make them present the opportunity to the kids. And give them what it actually is. Don't make it seem like it's that 1950 smoky, dirty shop. That's basically what I think. I mean, you got to let them know that there is chances for success.
Preston says he isn't sure what he's going to do when he graduates from high school, but he says he's glad to have manufacturing experience on his resume. Brianne Shasau, Wisconsin Public Radio News.
Eric Lawrenson also contributed to this report. For more coverage on young people and manufacturing in Wisconsin, visit WPR.org/news.
student loan debt is making a lot of headlines lately. Earlier in the show, we talked about Governor Walker's proposal out today to freeze tuition at the University of Wisconsin system for another 2 years. In a lot of states, lawmakers are cutting college funding as tuition rates go up, and students and their families are taking on more and more debt.
And while it may seem like a good idea at the time, when students have to repay the debt, it can hold them back from other investments. It's hard to make a car payment on top of a loan payment, for example. Experts say student loan debt is widening the wealth gap in America.
We want to hear from you on this. Do you have student loan debt? Has it held you back from doing things like buying a new car, buying a house, saving for retirement? Do you feel like you're falling behind your peers maybe without that big student loan debt? Call in now and share your experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send us an email at talk@wpr.org.
William Elliott joins us now. He's the director of the Assets and Education Initiative in the School of Social Welfare at the University of Kansas. Willie, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Veronica.
Well, the issue of income inequality has gotten a lot of attention lately, and now college debt is being called out as part of that problem. How does a big college debt load contribute to the upward mobility of college grads?
Well, what our research suggests is that, for instance, if someone, if we compare two people, one who went to college and had student debt and one who did not, they would have about 63% less net worth. And they would have about 40% less home equity and about 52% less retirement savings. So one way that student debt is impacting families is through their ability to accumulate assets shortly after leaving college.
Well, the common wisdom goes you go to college, you can get a better paying job. Does that idea, getting a higher paying job, does that counteract some of the financial burden of student debt?
I think what we're talking about is the equity issue as much as anything else. And so if you're a doctor, you go to school to be a doctor and you graduate, you'll get a good job in a hospital. But compared to your counterpart who also is a doctor, graduated from the same school, you'll end up having taking longer to reach the American dream and having less of that American dream. I think one interesting finding from research from Demos and Robert Hilton Smith was he also looked at income and debt, and what he found was that if you have two people to graduate, one with student debt and one without student debt, the person with student debt will start off at the same income level, but by the time they reach their 40s, they'll have less income. And so one might ask why that is, and that's because income really consists of three components: your labor income, but also your capital income and transfers. And here we're really talking about capital income. And people with student debt don't buy real estate, they don't buy stocks and bonds at the same level. And so ultimately, their personal income ends up being less than those without student debt.
How widespread is this issue for the millennial generation right now?
Well, I think it's quite widespread. We know that student debt now is higher than credit card debt, and it's about $1 trillion. And so I don't think anyone will call in and won't have talked to someone who has large amounts of student debt and is impacting their lives. We all know somebody that way.
We've got a lot of folks waiting to talk to you already. And by the way, you can get in on the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. Want to know how student loan debt is affecting your life? Is it holding you back from doing other things like saving for retirement or buying a car or buying stocks? 1-800-642-1234. And let's go right now to Stephanie joining us in Milwaukee. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi there.
What do you think?
I've experienced what you guys are talking about. It's great that you are covering the topic because I think it is something that a lot of us in my age are dealing with. And personally have close to about $45,000 in student loan debt. And for me, the only way I've been able to kind of look forward to taking those next steps in life is by having a fiance who doesn't have any student loan debt and with good credit. And he has a car. So I mean, living without him in the 5 years before we met, it was riding a bicycle and sharing housing with other people. And the idea of buying a house or buying a car just weren't even on my radar. It was just the fact that I put myself through college as the first person in my family to do that, and now dealing with the repercussions of it.
So
but having a partner that's helping me with that.
You've got a partner who can help you. But would you do it all over again? Would you choose to go to college and take on the amount of debt that you took on?
I wouldn't. No, I don't think I would. And in dealing with counselors the way that they were available in my school system. I don't think it was as much of an option. It was kind of like you don't go to college or you do. And for me, I just always knew that I wanted to go to college and didn't really have, I think, the resources to explain the repercussions of putting yourself through college for 5 years and what the rest of your life looks like after that.
Stephanie, thank you so much for calling and sharing what your experience has been like. And Willie, what about that? She said if she had to do it all over again, she might not go to college. So is this sort of a debt load going to affect people's feelings about what it means to go to college?
Well, I definitely think it has potential of affecting what we perceive as our return on college. And that's why we talk about the equity issue of someone going who has debt and who doesn't have debt. It really gets down to what we're getting out of college and is it enough? Is there enough return after the debt? And if you can't get a home and you don't get married as young as you would, there's evidence to suggest that you won't if you have student debt, then you might really begin to think, did I make the right decision? I would argue that you did because our evidence does suggest that you'll still be better off than if you didn't go to college, but you won't be as well off as others who went to college without student debt.
But what kinds of students are actually getting through college without debt?
Those with either lots of scholarships or who have parents who are able to help save and finance their college education. And some, I should also add, some students are able to work several jobs and do it over a longer period of time and are also able to get out with minimal amount of debt.
Part of the critique about who's getting the scholarships is that instead of going to students based on need, it's going to students with higher test scores, and that sometimes the students with higher test scores are the students who have more advantages, maybe coming from wealthier families. Is that what you're seeing?
I think that is the case, and it corresponds with this whole shift towards putting more of the burden that you spoke about with states taking less funding and families have to pay more. At the same time that was happening, the type of aid that was available became much and much more related to academic performance than need-based aid. So you have both the families having to pay more and more of the aid going to those who are in a better position to do well in school in the first place.
We're talking right now to William Elliott from the University of Kansas about how student loan debt is widening the wealth gap in the United States.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Ricker. We're continuing our conversation on student loan debt with William Elliott, Director of the Assets and Education Initiative in the School of Social Welfare at the University of Kansas.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Is your student loan debt dragging you down economically, making you feel poorer than you would otherwise, maybe making you regret the decision to go to college in the first place? Call 800-642-1234. Or send an email, talk@WPR.org.
And let's go back to the phones. We've got Kathleen, who is joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Kathleen.
Hello. How are you?
Good. What do you think about the issue of college loan debt?
Well, I was a person that I always had a dream, and I went back to law school when I was 42 and got out with, of course, a huge amount of debt because I didn't have anything to liquidate except my retirement, which I did. And so I came out of law school, no retirement, and essentially not many job prospects because nobody knew what to do with older returning professionals in my law profession. So I had to hang out my own shingle. And it took me until age 72 to pay off my loan.
It's interesting because doctors, lawyers, these are high-status professions that generally come with a high paycheck and the kind of job that you typically think of could boost you up a socioeconomic class or two. Did you find that?
No, not at all. I mean, I love practicing on my own. I love the law, so I'm happy with my choice. But quite honestly, I have seen other people in my same predicament that are very unhappy.
Well, thank you so much for sharing what you went through, Kathleen. And Willie, what do you think about that?
No, I think it's something we're seeing increasingly, and it's a concern because we do need people to go into a variety of fields. And if only certain fields are going to really pay off, then it becomes a problem. You would think that law school would be one of those ones that pays off, but there is a lot of lawyers And so that does hurt to some degree. But even if you're thinking about engineering or computers or technology more broadly, we need lawyers, we need social workers, we need different types of people. People teach education, teachers. And if the loans are so heavy that they can't pursue those types of fields, then it creates large problems for society as a whole.
Would you say it's become the point that we are in sort of a paradox? Someone goes to college so that they can become upwardly mobile, maybe be the first one in their family to go to college, and ideally that would be something that would move them up, but instead the student loan debt keeps them down, so it's kind of a wash.
Here again, I would say the evidence suggests that it's probably not a wash for most people on average, but the problem is if we want people to go to college and we need people to go to college to fulfill certain jobs, it's a much harder decision to make now. That the advantage might not be as evident to them, given all the debt that they'll have to face for the first 10 to 20 to 30 years of their lives.
Well, let's go back to the phones now. Matthew is joining us from La Crosse. Hi, Matthew.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What do you think about student loan?
Well, I just want to comment on the fact that I went to school for many years and doing it on my own dime, taking a lot of loans on, a lot of debt on, and I ended up graduating from two separate schools and I have two separate degrees, and the entire time I was doing that, they were basically selling to me that I'll be able to get a good job, I'll be able to pay off these loans in no time. I've been graduated out of school for almost 10 years, and the entire time I've tried to get a job in the field I have degrees in, no one will hire me.
So it's been a difficult situation for you. Is it something that you've been able to work your way through? Have you gotten what you thought you would out of it?
No, it's been a complete loss for me. I'm sitting on two degrees I cannot use, I do not use, and there's no prospects in using it. I finally ended up going back to a technical college, and it worked out better than a regular four-year university did, but I'm still sitting with all those loans that the people sold to me, basically saying that it would get me a better job, and it hasn't.
All right. Well, thank you so much for calling, Matthew. Appreciate that, and good luck to you in your search for work. And Willie, you're saying that what we found is that you are still better off with a college degree. But is the amount of student loan debt enough, as we're hearing from our callers here, that it is suppressing at least upward mobility?
No, 100%. I think that is the case, and particularly when we think, once again, about equity. If we in America believe that effort and ability should lead towards desired outcomes, and that people who have similar levels of effort and ability should have similar types of outcomes, in the kind of system we've created where we're so dependent upon college debt, it means that two people of equal effort and ability might not have the same kinds of outcomes. And that just breaks down the whole motivation for moving forward, for looking at education as a possibility for moving up the ladder, and for education to serve as a ladder of opportunities. And so, yes, I mean, I do agree that we need to find ways to reduce the amount of debt that students take on. It wasn't until 1982 that really debt became the main driver or main way that we financed college. And so there was a time, and there is a time, you know, we could think of not that far ago, where student debt wasn't the main focus in the main way that we financed college.
Well, I know you've got some ideas of your own about ways to incentivize people to save for college. What are some of your thoughts?
Yes, I do think so. I think there's a number of things we could do. And what we really talked about is starting from birth, and so you have long times and you can get compound interest over time to save for college. I mean, it's not something you can start saving for in 10th grade and expect to save enough money to finance college. Beyond that, we also need to have both private institutions and government find ways to help supplement our saving. And so we talk about children's savings accounts, which allow families to get initial deposits, sometimes about $500 or $1,000, depending upon the program. And then their money they put in the account is matched one-to-one through state or federal funds. There's a number of states now, to include Maine, who have opened up these types of accounts for families. I think that's one way to begin to address the long-term problem of student debt. But it doesn't help those who are already in debt. And I think we have to find other ways to kind of help those people who have already gone to college and already, you know, experiencing this heavy debt load beyond income-based payments. And so I think we have to think creatively about it. I'll mention one other thing quickly, is we've talked about in ways of financing it, potentially using the Pell Grant as an early commitment program where they were given some percentage of the Pell Grant if they were qualified for it in fifth grade. And so they could leverage that money, have a nice sum of money in their account, not use anything but college. And then their families will be able to save as well, and in the end would end up being more money for college than it would have been if they just got the Pell Grant.
Okay, so there's one idea on the table. Let's go back to our phones now. Mary joining us from Rhinelander. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to talk to you about my daughter who is out of college and has been for a number of years, and she has decided that she wishes to enter religious life. And she, along with about 10,000 other people who want to enter religious life, are unable to do it because they have to pay all their college loans back prior to entering.
Ah, so this is a unique problem that Mary has. I mean, not unique in terms of the debt, but what sorts of solutions is your daughter pursuing?
About 42% of those 10,000 people cannot enter religious life because of student loan debt.
Wow. Well, Mary, thank you for telling us about your story. This isn't one that apparently a number of people, not just Mary's daughter, are facing. Willie, what happens when debt gets in the way of people's life calling?
I think that's what we were talking about a little bit earlier, that this is the potential, if we rely so heavily on our financial aid system, rely so heavily on debt, that it really can end up steering people into different types of jobs because they cannot realistically pay back the loans. And that's not just religious studies, but in a number of areas. There's just not, whether something means something as basic as being a teacher or, like I said, social work or many other different kinds of humanities, all these types of professions might not pay enough to warrant the kind of debt you take on.
We've only got about 30 seconds left, Willie, but if the current rate of debt continues for students and families, what's at stake if students decide that they just can't afford to go to college?
Well, I think, you know, as we become increasingly technological in society and more jobs require some post-secondary education, the ability to fill those jobs will deplete. We won't be able to fill the jobs as with our own people, at the very least. And that's a huge problem for the country and for future generations.
Thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
That was William Elliott, Director of the Assets and Education Initiative in the School of Social Welfare at the University of Kansas.